Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, Adam, we will be talking with Dr. Brian Goldstein, UNC Hospital's Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer, about being on the front lines of medicine.
Yeah, well, Dr. Brian Goldstein, no relationship to Dr. Adam Goldstein, beloved
co-host. Although you'd like to claim him, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, certain things I'd like to claim, but when we hear about his responsibilities and the experiences of running a multi-billion dollar healthcare system, oh my goodness, I'm looking forward to that conversation.
I am too. But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about putting babies on their back to sleep and getting flat spots on the head.
That's not a good thing, is it?
No.
But we'll also be talking about guns ownership among young kids.
And about samples in your doctor's closet and whether or not they're helpful.
And then finally, we're supposed to talk to men about prostate-specific antigen testing. Is that talking actually working? We'll find out. Let's dive right in, Christy, about these flat spots on infants. Let's tell us about that.
Okay. So the deal is that we started telling people many years ago to put their babies on their back to sleep to cut the rate of sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS. And this is very important because it does decrease the rate of babies dying from SIDS.
But unfortunately, researchers found they sampled 442-month-olds in routine checkups, and almost half of them had what's called positional, and if I'm saying this wrong, Christy, you let me know, plagiocephaly. That's a really
right.
tough word that just means flatheads.
Yes, plagiocephaly, and it's something that is near and dear to me because my daughter had this pretty significantly as an infant. And a lot of our patients have this. Obviously, about half of the patients at 2 months old have this. The good news is that it is largely a cosmetic issue. A lot of babies with more tummy time and just being turning their heads away from the flat spot to the other side will help sort of round out their heads over time. And kids do just fine.
This was published in the journal Pediatrics. And there are things that parents can do to prevent this, like making sure that when their child is awake and they're being watched carefully, that they're on their tummy time and under their watchful eye. And so, because even though it's not medically damaging, it is for many parents medically alarming.
Absolutely. I was worried my daughter would have lopsided ponytails, but she has ponytails down there just fine.
Well, let's talk about our very next research that matters, Christy. And this was one that's so concerning to me. You know, co-authors and myself had this recent New England Journal of Medicine article about carrying concealed weapons. And so I'm much more in tune to research on weapons. And when it involves weapons in youth, I get concerned.
I have to say, Adam, this was shocking to me. So this was research that showed of adolescents and youth that show up to the emergency room for a assault-related injury, that 1/4 of them, 1/4 of them, own guns.
Yeah, they had 159 of these adolescents came into this emergency room in Michigan, and they had been assaulted in some form or fashion. They had suffered a victimization. And so the question is, well, what about these kids? And they were administered a survey, and they admitted to having guns. And this raises all kinds of questions because there are revenge motives at play. Maybe they had these guns because they were worried about assaults. This is a high-risk group.
And most of the weapons were obtained illegally, and 22% of the gun owners said that they had an automatic or a semi-automatic firearm. So these are children carrying very dangerous weapons.
And this research that was in the journal Pediatrics as well really suggests that when a young adolescent comes to your doctor and has suffered an assault, one really should have this conversation. Do you own a gun? Not one that I would have really thought about But certainly going with weapons in schools and concerns, it's one that we need to add to our training list of questions.
Absolutely. Let's talk about sample medications in doctor's closets. We've cut these out in our closets at home. No, not our closets at home. But
we're not closet sample users.
I think most people remember a time where a lot of doctors carried all kinds of sample medication from drug reps that they could give to their patients.
And increasingly, doctors don't carry those samples in large part because of some research suggesting that the majority of those samples ended up in the doctor's family's homes or the staff's homes, and that they were not samples that were actually the ones indicated most for conditions. And this is some research in today's time from the Journal of the American Board of Family Medicine looking at 10 sample closets in internal medicine, family medicine offices in the Phoenix area.
And they found that 96% of the medications in the sample closets were like brand name, where there was a generic medication for the same indication.
Generic. Yep.
Medication, so a cheaper generic medication that was available that worked just as well on the market, but yet most of what was in the closet was a trade name expensive medication.
And only one of these sample medications was recommended as a first line therapy by the evidence. And so these are potentially very costly. The mean cost of a 1 month supply of a starting dose of these samples was $178. Many generic medicines are available for $8, $10 a month nowadays. It really calls into question, why are there still samples?
Well, and I think from the pharmaceutical and the drug company perspective, that's a way to get in their brand names into patients and have them trust that brand. But if we know that the cheaper medications work just as well or are, in fact, better or more indicated, then I think it's unethical for us as physicians to be promoting them.
I think if you are receiving a sample medication, there are a certain number of questions that you probably could ask your doctor about to really make sure you're getting the right medicine. And I think Christy and I both think that perhaps samples should be something that we can wave goodbye to maybe 10 years down the road. Let's look at our very last research that matters, Christy, about prostate-specific antigen, or that PSA testing, in men older than 70 years, also a research that was in the Journal of the American Board of Family Medicine.
So the context here to know is that most men die with prostate cancer rather than from prostate cancer. And specifically, if men are older than 70 years, there's a lot of controversy on whether or not this PSA testing should be done at all. And if so, it's certainly recommended that we involve patients in shared decision-making about the benefits and the harms from the testing.
And what was interesting in this particular situation is that only a quarter of the men that actually had testing reported having discussions about the testing, the advantages or the disadvantages of testing. And it really goes to show the real problem increasingly, I think, that we as doctors and our listeners as patients have with the PSA testing, which is there's so much uncertainty and the authorities do not recommend it anymore. Can we really fairly describe advantages to the testing? I don't think so, Christy.
Well, and only a quarter of them had a discussion at all about the benefits and the advantages and disadvantages. And then there were some differences of if the physician just said, well, there are scientific uncertainties about it, that didn't seem to affect whether or not a patient decided to get it or not. And so it really raises the question of how do we succinctly explain the shared decision-making involved patients in the decision for something that is pretty darn complicated. I don't know if you have any tips, Adam, but I find it challenging.
I think that it's a long conversation. Mm-hmm. It's a difficult conversation. And perhaps talking more about the uncertainty, that probably doesn't lead to higher use. Well, that'll conclude a Research That Matters, Christy. We've been able to talk about a little bit about PSA testing and uncertainty.
About injured youth, a quarter of them owning guns.
About potentially saying goodbye to sample medication closets.
And about half of infants having a little flat spot on their head from sleeping on their back, which is still recommended. Put your babies on your back to sleep.
We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Brian Goldstein, UNC Hospital's Executive Vice President, Chief Operating Officer, about being on the front lines of medicine. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Brian Goldstein, no relationship to me, UNC Hospital's Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer, about being on the front lines of medicine.
We're so glad you're with us, Dr. Goldstein.
Thank you.
You know, I'm interested in your career trajectory, and I actually don't know this story. When you became a physician and went into medical school, did you set out to be the leader or a major leader of such an enormous healthcare system?
Well, first, thanks for having me. No, I didn't ever set out specifically to be a leader in a system of the size that UNC Healthcare has become, although I'm gratified to have done so. But I did decide pretty early in my career that I, just like some of my classmates were choosing cardiology or family medicine or pediatrics, I chose as my specialty a combination of practicing general internal medicine and wanting to be a physician executive. So I actually decided to go to business school after my third year of medical school and was able to combine both degrees and then pick up my training from there.
Hmm. So you were in practice, because I remember you coming over to the University of North Carolina, and I seem to have blinked somewhere, and all of a sudden you are now leading what is one of the largest employers in the state of North Carolina. Tell us what it's like. You always seem so calm. It can't be that easy.
Well, I was calm until you reminded me that I'm part of the leadership of one of the largest employers in the state. Now, that's a hefty responsibility, and I do take that seriously. One reason I'm calm is having been on the faculty and in practice here at UNC for 13 years, I know the quality of the people throughout the organization. So that's been a real advantage. I've been in this role for 3 years now, but before that I spent 8 years as the sort of the bridge between the doctors and the hospital, the chief of staff for the hospital, and one of the, since we're an academic center, you know, one of the executive associate deans. So I've got a pretty good feel for how good our managers are, how good our doctors are, how good our residents are. That helps.
So give us a sense then of on the front lines of medicine, what are the types of things that come at a leader like yourself in large academic healthcare systems across the country? Give us a sense of two or three of the types of things, maybe today earlier, but the things that you have to deal with.
Sure. It's a real hodgepodge. No 2 days are the same, probably like you all. So let me try to come up with a couple of examples. We're constantly working on trying to improve care. Over the last several years, like pretty much every healthcare enterprise, we've had better data to show us where we're doing well and where we need to improve. So we're trying in a more constant way to look at that information and improve every day. So I get letters from patients and caregivers that tell me what we're doing well and sometimes where we need to improve. And tomorrow we'll have our monthly meeting with 300 of our managers, and we'll share some of those stories with people. So one of the fun things I get to do is to sift through that information and decide what, you know, how to share that with our staff. A more quantitative example is, we have great, as you know, great infection control group But we also know care is so complicated that we still see some hospital infections, people who come into the hospital without an infection and either acquire one or because their immune system is damaged, they develop something in the hospital. And we're constantly working to minimize those. And in fact, we've made great strides in reducing things like pneumonias in people with ventilators and bloodstream infections with people with catheters. So something like 80 or 90% reductions in the rates of those infections in the last decade. But we still have room to improve. So, you know, I'll look at data. I'll exchange some emails or phone calls. I had a conversation with one of our infection control nurses the other day about what, you know, what else could the hospital be doing to help with a stubborn problem in a specific intensive care unit. So that's an example. Another big thing that looms over all of us in healthcare is how can we mitigate, reduce, frankly, or at least reduce the rate of rise of costs to provide the best care in an environment where we know that our reimbursement isn't going to keep up with historical trends, right? The way we get paid is going to change. The amount we get paid is already changing. And we know already that if we're going to continue to be able to fulfill our mission, we have to not only improve efficiency, but we actually literally have to figure out ways to, you know, reduce the cost per patient served.
So a large part of this is in improving the quality, reducing the cost of the care of the patients that we have, which I imagine, how many patients do we take care of in the UNC healthcare system? A lot.
Around 37,000 discharges from the hospital per year, over 1 million people in our clinics per year.
So improving the quality of the care that we're giving to them, but also as a public institution, we have we're leading the way for care of the people in our state and across the nation to come up with new examples and new data, new evidence behind improvements in these cares. How do you balance sort of caring for the people that we have and trying to also have the forward thinking of caring for the larger population?
Mm-hmm. So that's also a very good question, Christy. That's a daily challenge, partly because there's uncertainty about how we get paid, right? And traditionally, hospitals and doctors in this country, up until a few years ago, were pretty consistently paid. Sort of the more you do, the more you get paid, with less concern for what was the outcome. And that's starting to change. So Medicare certainly has got some very specific programs in place to change that, to both reward hospitals for demonstrably better care, to some degree penalize hospitals for care that's below their predicted standard. So in that, we're sort of in a transition zone. As you pointed out, we have to balance, I guess, we have to balance what I would call patient advocacy, where we're advocating for the best for every individual patient, with an equal obligation to spread resources that we have to as many patients as possible. So we have assistance programs through pharmacy and, of course, through things like emergency services that we're hell-bent to sustain. But as the reimbursement changes, it's going to get more of a challenge to keep business as usual.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we come back, I want to continue this conversation with Dr. Brian Goldstein about how one balances these competing tensions. And then also, do you ever take risk? And what does that mean to take risk as an academic health center? Because that's what leadership sometimes is. And how does that come about? We'll be right back with Your Health with our guest, Dr. Brian Goldstein, talking about the front lines of medicine. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Brian Goldstein, UNC Hospital's Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer, about being on the front lines of medicines and the many challenges and opportunities he has as one of the major leaders of UNC healthcare system. Dr. Goldstein, we talked a little bit about the challenges of leadership, and Adam alluded that there are a number of risks you have to take as a leader. And we wonder, what is the biggest risk, or what is an example of a big risk that UNC Hospitals has had to take recently? Is it the purchasing of or relationships with new hospitals and expansion, or is it the financial uncertainty? What kinds of risks are you having to take considering all these competing demands?
So there are a few that stand out, Christy. You just mentioned one, which is partnering with some other hospitals around the state in a way that expands our footprint and allows us to bring our way of healthcare more conveniently to different parts of the state. But as you say, that is a big investment in a world where we already talked about where how we get paid, how much is a little uncertain. There's risk there. Closer to home, as you know, we're building a hospital in Hillsboro. And I don't know if that will seem like a big risk to your listeners, but to us it is. It's an investment at a time where, the demand for services, the reimbursement's a little bit uncertain. So we view it as an informed risk. It allows us to the hospital in Hillsboro and the medical office building, which just opened a few weeks ago, are ways to bring more convenient services to Northern Orange County and Durham County and Alamance County. But more importantly for us, the Hillsboro Hospital is a chance for UNC Healthcare to really focus certain services in a facility that can be designed around standards and protocols and efficiency. And if you're probably going to ask about accountable care, and when we come back to that, you'll see, I think, why it's so important for us to be able to have a place where we can take care that's amenable to those things in a facility where we can do it more efficiently than we can at the big, complex academic medical center.
Yeah, so today or yesterday, we all got paid based on charges. Tomorrow or sometime in the future, we get paid based on quality and caring for large populations. This is an accountable care organization. But how do you make the case for paying for tomorrow with today's resources? Can you do that, or are you doing that?
This is probably one of the biggest challenges we face, is how do you make that transition from our current world to the world where we all think things are heading, and do it in a measured way? It's a big culture change, of course. It's a change for our physicians, including you and me. It's a change for our patients.
In what way? How do they find that? How would our patients notice a difference in a if we were all in this large accountable care organization versus a large fee for service? What do you think they would notice?
That's a really good question. Well, what I would hope they would notice is more convenient access to what I would call first contact services. So in a good accountable care system, you want to be able to get the patient to the right intensity of service as quickly as possible. And I would also hope they would see very transparent information about how safe the care is, quality of care. Depending on circumstances, there are certain forms of what I would call discretionary care where their out-of-pocket contribution might go up depending on the insurance plan they had. There might be certain things the insurer is going to ask them to pay more for if the insurer considers it elective or discretionary. And I think while we improve access to the right intensity of services, I can also see the potential for it taking longer to get certain forms of elective services, just because we're shifting the balance to better meet what we think is need. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It does. And, you know, we're talking a lot about reimbursement, and that's a huge challenge that the whole healthcare system is facing. And I wonder, for our listeners, if it would be worth outlining why that's so important. It's more than just UNC Healthcare making money so that the doctors can, nurses can get paid. But there's an element of the value of financial stability of an organization to care for the patients and what we can do with research dollars, et cetera. But I wonder if you might outline a little bit of that for our listeners to understand why these pressures are so important.
Sure. As you pointed out, we, you know, like most hospitals in North Carolina and most healthcare systems, we are a not-for-profit, which means we don't have shareholders, we don't pay dividends. We reinvest every penny into the care. Our caregivers are paid salaries, which means they don't directly benefit either from whether the system earns more or less in a given year. But with all that, we have a mission, which is to be of service to the people of North Carolina and to really provide comprehensive services to our local community and complex care to people across the entire state and even beyond, but especially to the people of North Carolina. So we hate when things happen, like a fire at a chicken processing plant or an outbreak, an epidemic of a SARS virus. But, you know, when those things happen, we want to be completely available to provide the best care. When new techniques for transplantation become available, we want to make those, you know, accessible to the people of North Carolina, just as they are elsewhere. And honestly, for some complex chronic conditions, we feel like we're uniquely positioned to, as I said earlier, get people the right care as quickly as possible. So if you're unfortunately suffering from a chronic condition like an inflammatory bowel condition or cystic fibrosis or hemophilia or cancer, sometimes it takes an academic center to be able to give you the latest, combine what's going on with research and relieve your suffering as quickly as possible. So to do all that, we, as you said, we do have to generate a margin somehow, keep it going.
Well, Dr. Goldstein, thank you for taking time with us and for leading our institution well and for leading the way as we care for the people of North Carolina and for taking the time with us today.
Thank you again for having me. It's a pleasure.
We'll have you back on in a year or two to talk about that next generation of technology.
Okay.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to talk a little bit about your health questions and your concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our guest producer today, Dr. Liz Baltero, one of our residents at UNC Family Medicine, to read us our very first House Call question.
I was out in the sun recently, and I'll admit that I didn't use as much sunblock as I normally do. I think I have sun poisoning now. Is there anything to relieve the pain and irritation besides Benadryl?
Ouch.
That's painful.
It's painful for me to think about it. And so important to, as you know, and as you're suffering from it, to use sunblock, and particularly to stay in the shade and avoid those big daytime hours in the sun.
And unfortunately, once the damage occurs, there's not a lot one can do. People talk about doing aloe vera, or get the salve from an aloe plant and putting it on some of those areas, and that can be healing. Anything that has a cooling anti-inflammatory, like a steroid cream. Some people find that taking an aspirin early on can actually help significantly with the pain of a sunburn.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of trying things on top of the skin, and also Tylenol, Motrin, or aspirin, as you suggest, to try to reduce the pain. And thankfully, your skin will heal, and you can will go forward and be a little more careful.
You know, Christy, I was recently on vacation, and I saw two gentlemen that had been out in the sun for like 2.5 hours, and we were in Scottsdale, Arizona, in the desert. And they were so red, lobster red and burned. And the people I were with was saying, should we go say something or not? And they were arguing about it themselves. And this has been going on for about 30 minutes. So finally, I got up and I went over to them. And I said, you may not realize this, but you are really already have a first degree, almost a second degree burn. Maybe you would like to get underneath the shade and move in. And we then had a long discussion. Should we say something to someone in the future? But I don't know. I did.
Well, I think you did it kindly, and I think, you know, we have to look after one another that way. Sometimes people just don't know.
I said I'm a family doc. Is it okay if I tell you? We got permission.
Unsolicited advice.
Speaking of permission, Liz, what is our very next house call?
The 7 minutes science-based workout is getting a lot of buzz. Do you think this exercise regime is enough to sustain a healthy lifestyle?
Well, I'm intrigued and fascinated, and I must admit, I didn't know very much about this.
Okay, well, I had to look it up, too. So it's a variety of, it's 12 exercises that require a chair and a wall in your body. You do each exercise for 30 seconds, rest for 10 seconds between each. And it's a variety of things from jumping jacks to a wall sit to push-ups and crunches and step-ups. And it sounds kind of similar to what I'm doing at CrossFit these days, minus the weights. Can it sustain a healthy lifestyle? I really don't think we have enough information. I would say it's certainly better than not doing anything. And it has some strength elements to it that are, I think, positive. So I think it's a good thing. I just don't know, is it enough to answer your question?
We like the buzz about it. Though we must say it's 7 minutes a day, not 1 minute a day for 7 days. That's not a 7 minute a workout there. We don't think it's bad. It's got to be good. Anyone who gets out and moves is better than when it's not. So we like it.
I like it too. We'll have to come back and give you more information. Maybe I'll try it.
Let's have our health science librarians, if they would, they'll post the 7 minute workout on our website.
Let's do it. Will you try it, Adam? We can come back and talk about it.
We'll let you know.
Okay. Let's take our very next house call.
I have sporadic acne on my back and have changed my body wash multiple times. How can I get rid of it?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And, you know, I guess people underappreciate sometimes how difficult sometimes certain acne elements can be to get rid of.
And the good news is there are medications that can make a difference. There are some basic things like changing your body wash, like showering right after exercise, and paying attention to general hygiene. But there are also medications to treat acne these days that I think a lot of people don't realize.
Yeah, there are topical antibiotics. There are topical what's called retinoids that people can get prescriptions for. And even sometimes seeing your doctor or the dermatologist, if you have a stubborn cyst that can be injected. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole host of ways of treating these stubborn acne cysts. And sometimes what looks like acne isn't acne. It's a different type of cyst. So we encourage you to maybe go see your doctor, talk about the range of therapies.
Absolutely. Let's take our next house call.
I try to drink a lot of fluids, but my mouth stays pretty dry. What could be causing this?
Really good question. And that is one in which we would have more questions right back at you. Yeah, like, what are the medications that you're taking? We would want to know that.
Yeah. And has this happened before? Is this something that's been going on a long time? Or is this something that started more recently? Could that coincide with the medication change? Or could there be something going on in your mouth, like some blockage or dysfunction in your glands that produce saliva?
Sometimes people get used to the sensation of drinking, and so their mouth feels dry, and they feel like they have to keep drinking, and that sometimes causes a problem too. This is one of those things, it's really worthwhile sitting down, writing all the medicines that you're taking, both prescription and over the counter, and having a more detailed conversation with your doctor or healthcare provider, and see what's happening in your environment that really could be contributing to a dry mouth, which is, by the way, very uncomfortable. Even a yeast infection sometimes can cause it. So lots of possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Let's take our very last house call today about urine changing color.
My urine has always been yellow, but in the last few days, I've noticed that it has a pink tint to it, too. Should I be worried?
Well, this is a good question. I'll be curious how Christy and I have not compared our answers for this particular question beforehand. And, I would just change the color. I wouldn't be so worried. I'd be more interested in what did you change in your diet?
It could be something in your diet, but sometimes a pink tint means that there's a little bit of blood in your urine.
That too, yes.
That could come from a kidney stone that maybe is not hurting yet. Usually if you have a kidney stone, it hurts and that you're more worried about that. But also it could be the beginning of an infection or something like a little small bladder cancer that can cause your urine to have blood in it. I don't want to scare you, but there are a variety of things.
You scared me, Christy.
I know. Well, you say the word cancer, it scares everyone. But it's true that if your urine has changed to a pink color, and it could have blood in it, and that's worth getting checked out.
Sometimes if you've been exercising a whole bunch mm-hmm. and you haven't really done much exercise for a while, particularly when we're out in this summer heat, that could cause a little pink color. I guess the bottom line is if it stays there mm-hmm. and doesn't go away, or if you're a smoker, which you have a higher risk of that cancer that Christy mentioned, you probably should be checked out. Hopefully it goes away and you continue to feel very good.
Well, thank you to everyone for giving us questions and for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you in your health. And we want you to share your questions and stories. So email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, on iTunes, and get our health app on your phone. You can also send questions that way.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. Our guest today, Dr. Brian Goldstein, and our great asker of house calls, Dr. Liz Baltero. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Talk with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.